Hi, my name is Lina Alarian. I'm the Executive Director of the Coalition for Civil Freedoms.
Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine. On
Thank
Friday,
you.
We have a film screening of Witness, a documentary film about the Arif Hossein sting case in Albany, and it follows the defendants, Yassin, Aref, and Mohammed Hossein, in their memories of the events leading up to their arrest and subsequent years. Your organization, the Coalition for Civil Freedoms, is one of the co-sponsors of this screening and subsequent panel discussion. Can you tell us about your organization?
Sure. Thank you for having me on. We're an organization that's dedicated to advocating for people we feel were created as political prisoners in the government's war on terror domestically after 9/11. Most of the prisoners that we support are Muslim. They were targeted for their faith, which we feel was criminalized by the government following the Patriot Act. It's passing the deployment of thousands of informants, FBI informants and undercover agents targeting people, targeting mosques, infiltrating communities, infiltrating places of worship, and, you know, just engaging in this fishing expedition of so-called terrorists. And so many of us are impacted by these policies and have come together to try to end them.
The war on terror was started by the government, but what role did media have in perpetuating this idea?
Of course, the role of the media has been exceptionally harmful, not just since 9/11, but even in the 90s. Growing up as a Muslim American in Florida, we've seen a noticeable shift after the end of the Cold War, painting Muslims as this new enemy in the Muslim world at large. My father, who was a political activist and professor in Florida, was targeted by our local newspaper for a decade, where thousands and thousands of articles were written about him, maligning him, smearing him, labeling him a terrorist for his advocacy in support of Palestinian human rights, for his advocacy in support of civil rights of Muslims in this country. And I witnessed it firsthand growing up. There was a really shoddy fake journalist whose work has been discredited, a self-described terrorism expert, Stephen Emerson, who made a documentary in which my father was maligned in it. And that kind of unleashed this decade-long investigation and, you know, two-decade-long criminalization of my father and other Muslim men in the community. So, you know, it isn't just that I've seen it, I've lived it. And I think it's so important that we work to, you know, change the narrative and reshift the narrative to one that presents, you know, these policies accurately, that explains the stories of these people who are often just simply, you know, labeled as criminals or terrorists, but in fact, were victims of these unjust policies.
You mentioned that you primarily work with people who are criminalized for their Muslim faith. How does that scale in demographics? What kind of demographics are you seeing for people who are targeted for their political standing?
What's interesting is that in the last decade, especially, we've seen a rise of Muslim converts, you know, American, Black, White, Latinx converts to Islam of all, you know, backgrounds, who are simply getting to know the faith, who, you know, tend to be a little bit too trusting of this older presenting as Muslim scholar or man or mentor in the community. In one case that I've, you know, learned about, it was a white American woman who was a convert to Islam and who had reached out to an imam that she didn't know. It was actually an informant posing as an imam, exploiting her, you know, trust in them as a spiritual figure, as a mentor, to try to entrap her in a terrorism sting. So it's been really just disheartening to see. I think it's caused a lot of mistrust in the community, people being suspicious of getting to know one another. In another case, the young man, he was a white man convert to Islam. It was the imam at the mosque that introduced him and his group of friends to the informant, thinking that they would have a lot in common. And in fact, the informant was there at the behest of the FBI to fish and find targets that they could entrap in building friendships for years, you know, these really close-knit friendships where they're, you know, staying at each other's homes and, you know, attending weddings and birthdays and, you know, intimate gatherings. But in fact, they're just trying to, you know, ensnare the person in a fake criminal act. So you'd be surprised. Of course, we have a lot of Black Americans, you know, who, of course, are targeted disproportionately by the criminal legal system, people who, for economic reasons, are ensnared in these plots, offered financial incentives. We have a lot of people who suffer from mental health issues, who have been diagnosed for years, and that still doesn't protect them from these harsh sentences or inspire any sort of leniency. The government acknowledges that these people suffer from mental health issues, and they still go after them.
Coalition for Civil Freedoms was founded by political prisoners for political prisoners. You told us earlier that about your own personal story with your father being targeted in Florida for his advocacy of civil rights for Muslims. How does this personal relationship to the criminalization of political beliefs reinforce what your organization is doing?
I think the biggest lesson is to not be afraid to speak out. I think my personal experiences have taught me that, you know, silence doesn't protect you. My father was an outspoken advocate. He was targeted, unfortunately. But, you know, I think his experience in the prison, in the federal prison system, you know, being kept in solitary confinement for 42 straight months at one point, being the only pre-trial detainee. I mean, he still hasn't even had his day in court, and he was kept in the maximum security unit of a federal prison. All of these things actually inspired him later on to start the Coalition for Civil Freedoms, because he saw the injustice of our criminal legal system, the injustices of the prison system, the types of people that, you know, are harshly, you know, sentenced or harshly treated, and especially demographics. I mean, those who are, you know, economically disadvantaged, educationally, who, you know, suffer from all sorts of vulnerabilities in this country. But specifically with his case, I mean, I think we as a family felt so unsupported. We were largely abandoned by our community, unlike Albany, where there was support for the defendants, where people kind of came out. We use the example in Albany almost as a model for how we wish other communities would act in the face of these injustices, because they shut down the abuses by the FBI going forward. They never had another entrapment cases. Unfortunately, my father's case, it wasn't an entrapment case. It was just a political targeting case. But since then in Florida, there were a number of entrapment cases that we've seen. We had a great community there of organizers outside of the Muslim community coming out, but still not enough critical mass to shut down these abuses by the government. And so we felt that this issue was underserved. You know, my father certainly did, and he always believes in a strength in numbers. He had organizing experience campaigning to end the use of secret evidence against Muslims in the 1990s. These were immigrants, Muslim men, who were detained for years without being charged with a single crime. They weren't released, they weren't deported, and they weren't able to confront their accusations. So my father lobbied and organized against that until they were able to free the two dozen or so men at the time who were targeted in those policies. But of course, the Patriot Act came after 9/11, and you know, everything was kind of like ramped up to 60 or 120 or whatever. And yeah, his post 9/11 hysteria allowed for these policies to go unchecked. And, you know, it was that Dick Cheney 1% doctrine that even if a person, there's a 1% chance of them being a terrorist, we're going to treat it as 100% certainty. So this created a lot of victims of people who were unfairly targeted by the government and criminalized, and their lives totally destroyed as a result. But there were certain nuances in my father's experiences that only people who have been in the prison system, who have, you know, suffered inside on the inside could tell you, which is, you know, things like making a phone call to family members, the exorbitant costs of, you know, being a prisoner in the federal prison system where it's so exploitative, families, the financial burden that they carry, having to send money to their loved ones to buy hygiene items, to buy food, to place calls. And so, you know, emotional, psychological, social support for the affected family members. I mean, there's a common saying for anyone who has a loved one locked up that when a loved one is imprisoned, the family member is imprisoned, you know, mentally with them, emotionally. You're constantly thinking about that person. Your thoughts are always with them. You're suffering as they are, but in a different way. And so fortunately or unfortunately, but, you know, there were just enough people that, you know, we were able to create an organization of impacted families. I mean, an impacted family member said, you know, how sad is it that there are so many victims that there are enough to create a whole conference around it, which is what we've also done for a decade, is we do an annual conference for families of political prisoners where we come together and we try to turn the victimization into empowerment, to try to lobby and advocate for our loved ones, to, you know, learn how to deal with the media, to speak about our cases, our loved ones' cases, to advocate for them, to reclaim the narrative of what happened, and really try to challenge, you know, the negative media coverage that we feel has unfairly presented our loved ones.
So talking about reshifting the narrative and telling stories from your own perspective or from a personal perspective, why is this film, Witness, by director Masoud Haq, important in that reshifting of the narrative?
Yeah, that's a really important question. I think the story of Yasin Arif and Hamad Hussein doesn't end at their conviction. I mean, they are, in the eyes of the government, in the media, convicted terrorists, but in the eyes of themselves, their families, and those who understand these policies, who have followed these unjust cases, they were and remain political prisoners and people who are victimized by the government. And so I think this education, this you know, work to correct the policies in the aftermath of 9/11, to create this oral history of what happened from our perspective, is really important and something that I hope we can support as a coalition, as advocates for these prisoners in the years going forward, to show the public the reality of what happened and not simply what's been written about them or what the government has said they were guilty of.
Thank you for joining us, Lina Al-Aryan.